Welcome back to the program. At no time in human history have we been better at fighting disease than we are today. Yet modern life has also made us so much more vulnerable to the threat of global pandemic. Moreover, the spread of human travel, interaction, in short, globalization, has made it imperative that we stay focused on where the next disease or pandemic might come from. For disease has also become globalized. No one is more on top of this issue than my guest today, Nathan Wolf. He's been referred to as the Indiana Jones of virus hunters. In fact, Nathan Wolf is the Larry Loki Visiting Professor in Human Biology at Stanford University. He is the founder and CEO of Global Viral Forecasting. He received his undergraduate degree at Stanford and his doctorate in immunology and infectious diseases from Harvard. He was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. And it is my pleasure to welcome Nathan Wolf to this program to talk about his new work, The Viral Storm, The Dawn of a New Pandemic Age. Nathan Wolf, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. One of the things that's there's a lot of things that are a little bit scary, but one of them is to think about human beings, as you say, as sort of one long chain of easily infected hosts. That in fact we're not all that diverse as a species, and that we're pretty easily infected, and once we are, it's pretty hard to stop.
It's absolutely amazing what's happened to human populations over the past few hundred years, which is really just sort of a mere sort of a blink in geological time. I mean, we've gone from a situation where we basically lived in small villages to a situation where we have flights that are connecting the most remote villages and places like D.C. or San Francisco or Tokyo within a day or so. And what that means is that new pandemics, wherever they emerge, they have the potential to be global.
The other aspect of it that adds to the frightening part of this is that sometimes these viruses can attack and it could be years before we start to see the symptoms.
That's exactly right. So if you look at something like HIV, part of the real sort of concerning element of a virus like HIV is that it infects individuals, it becomes transmissible very quickly, and yet there's some years before you actually see disease. So in a current environment where we're so incredibly interconnected, a virus like that, basically did. It spread globally before we could even see it happen. And there's nothing to stop something from doing that just right now. So people have the sense that, you know, perhaps we know all of the viruses that cross into humans and we're doing some sort of wonderful surveillance. And certainly my organization, Global Viral Forecasting, and some others are trying to do this. But the reality is if a virus like HIV got into the human population and started spreading and was not causing diseases right away, it could really spread globally before we'd have any clue about it.
One of the things that you talk about is the way that viruses and human beings have kind of evolved side by side throughout history. On one level, there's something comforting about that idea, but the viral side seems to have sort of gotten away from us at the moment.
Well, it's just one of these things. So if you stop and take a moment and just think about sort of the bay or the ocean or the soil or really your skin or your gut, our world is absolutely filled with microorganisms. In fact, even our bodies, estimates suggest that probably less than 10% of the cells between your shoes and your hat actually belong to yourself as a human, and the rest of them are microbial cells. And even a smaller fraction of the genetic diversity on board us as humans is really human genetic diversity. So we live in really rich microbial communities. And most of those, and this is the good news, Most of the microbes are neutral, and some of them are even beneficial. It's just a small number of microbes that really have the potential to be sort of devastating on a global level.
And to what extent do we need to worry about these viruses becoming resistant to any kind of treatment or any of the normal ways that we would go about addressing them?
So a lot of the viruses that we focus on have incredible mechanisms for changing their genetic information. So they basically are changing their blueprints all the time, and they do this through mutation, you know, simply natural changes in the blueprint. They also do this by swapping genes with other viruses when they land in the same cell. And what this means is that they have some real advantages with regards to the speed at which new variants can emerge. And so when you alter an environment by introducing a drug, whether it's, you know, whatever kind of microorganism, viruses and other microorganisms, because they have such short generation times, they can evolve very, very rapidly through some of these mechanisms to emerge resistant. And so we have to be very, very cautious about how we utilize, antibiotics and antivirals so as to not create a situation where we have things that we have no potential to control.
Did we lose a lot of time in the 60s and 70s where we had this kind of arrogant attitude that infectious disease had sort of come to an end?
I mean, we were certainly wrong about that, and I think we did lose time, although one of the things that I emphasize quite a bit in the book is that sort of we're experiencing this new dawn of science as well in the area of microbiology. Some of the sequencing technologies, many of which have been perfected, you know, right here in the Bay Area, provide us with incredible capacity to understand these microbial communities without having to culture them, which is what we had to do historically. And all of the sort of communication interconnectedness provides us with the capacity to, you know, catch a tweet or catch a blog or a news article on the other side of the planet that gives us an indication that an outbreak is occurring. And so if you came to my office, and I describe this also in the last chapter of the book, you know, you see not only virologists, it's not some sort of, what you would imagine a lab would be with a bunch of people with white coat. It also is, you know, has people who are, you know, wearing hoodies and could easily be, you know, at Facebook or Google that are searching the web for signals of the next pandemic. And so we have an unusual set of tools now, which really makes this a very, very interesting time to be trying to tackle this sort of problem.
It also makes it clear that the emphasis right now has to be on prevention as much as, if not more than, treating.
If you think back to sort of the Framingham studies, and these were the critical studies that showed that you could sort of you could predict and prevent things like heart disease and cancer. Before that time, you know, and it's not that long ago, 60s or really even into the early 70s, you would go to a cardiologist and basically there'd be nothing they could do. They'd have to wait for a heart attack and then they'd have bypass surgery. And if you went to a cardiologist these days and that was their best approach to heart disease, you would sue them for malpractice. With regards to pandemics, we're still back in that early stage where we basically wait for the heart attack and do our best to respond to it. And, you know, the exciting thing is that there is a growing movement. And I think here in the Bay Area, there's been a huge element of it. Organizations like the Skoll Global Threats Fund, as well as Google.org, that has, you know, focused energy on really trying to turn the tide to recognizing that it's not just with regards to heart disease and cancer, but also with regards to pandemics, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
How much has modern medicine and modern ability to treat disease been a problem with things like transfusions and transplants and even immunization?
Well, I spend one of the chapters in the book discussing this because really one of the central themes of the book is about how interconnected humans are and we are with animal populations. And I think we would be wrong to ignore the connections that are made by things like blood transfusions and by organ transplants. I mean, the good news is that we now protect against all of the known agents when we're screening, you know, in countries like the United States, blood for donation. But that wasn't always the case. And certainly, for example, the proliferation of needles, which has been going on for, you know, some time, some, you know, many hundreds of years, has created the connections between people that have allowed completely new viruses to emerge. So, for example, hepatitis C virus does not spread efficiently sexually. It really needs things like needles and contemporary medical technologies in order to spread. And so we wouldn't have hepatitis C today if we didn't have medical technologies. Now, on the other hand, I'm not saying that the sort of costs outweigh the benefits. Certainly, we also wouldn't have eradicated smallpox, which was one of the most devastating blights in human history.
There's also the danger, and it's why the Department of Defense is paying so much attention, you talk about, to your work, the dangers of this being spread man-made.
It's very much the case that if you think about the differences between sort of chemical, nuclear, and biological threats, the sort of difficulty of, you know, the bar to entry for developing sort of biological weapons to be used in terrorism is ridiculously low, and the technologies continue to proliferate. So I think we have to be very, very concerned with you know, thinking about the possible use of agents, biological agents, in a way that could be, you know, very, very disruptive and potentially very deadly. And one of the things that we do in partnership with, you know, partners of the DoD and also with countries around the world is work to make sure to secure collections so that wherever we are, repositories need to be safe and these sorts of things need to be, you know, to be well documented. We need to know where they are, and also just to engage scientists globally to be working on controlling natural threats. We certainly think natural threats are, you know, a bigger threat to the overall human population, but it's just really a matter of time before there's a substantive disruption associated with another sort of bioterror incident.
And the degree to which our genetic research and our DNA research continues to move forward, in what ways will those areas be able to help us fight these potential pandemics?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you one area that we've been very interested in is, believe it or not, if you take a drop of blood, there's still no way to definitively determine all of the viruses in that drop of blood. And that's something that will surprise many people. And the technology is increasingly improving and allowing us to be able to do that. But I think some of the problem will really be some clever bioinformatics. And so it ends up being one of these great big data problems that are of such huge focus in Silicon Valley today, which is, how do we sort through all of this massive amounts of genetic information to see signals which will tell us what the different viruses are? Because right now, the only way to identify the genetic sequence of a virus is to find a match for it that exists out there that somebody's already sequenced. So the things that don't have matches are very, very difficult to discover.
When we look at particularly the large developing cities in the third world, in the developing world, and we see that kind of density with minimal amounts or evolving amounts of public health, to what extent are these the hot spots that we need to be concerned about?
We are just starting in this effort to understand where the viral hotspots on the planet are. This is work that's been going on for the last 5 or 6 years, and there certainly are some patterns. Earlier work that we did really sort of demonstrated some interesting features suggesting that most of the major diseases of humanity come from regions of the old world, parts of Africa and Asia. There's very good reason to suspect that new viruses will be jumping more from regions where you have high amounts of wild animal diversity, just because each animal species has its own diversity of viruses. So if you go to places where you have huge biodiversity, there's more viruses to emerge. And so that does tend to point us to regions that, tropical regions like Central Africa and Southeast Asia, where we spend a lot of time studying. But it's then that sort of interface, we think, between contact of humans, huge diversity of wild animals, and these sorts of larger cities or transportation hubs that we need to focus on. And so that's why if you look at the map of the 20 different countries around the world that we work in, it'll be regions like that are very, very highly represented.
How about genetic manipulation in terms of farming and industrial farming? How much of a threat does that pose?
I mean, certainly there are situations where when you alter the connectivity between species, then you definitely alter the way that these things are spread. That's sort of it's a double-edged sword. It can work in both directions. It's definitely the case that in contemporary society, many, many folks have fewer contact with animals, and that actually serves to decrease the transmission of some of these viruses, and it's one of the reasons why we focus on places where people are still hunting and butchering for their livelihoods. On the other hand, if you think about something like mad cow disease, interestingly, the current wisdom on the emergence of mad cow disease was originally this was a prion, which is the kind of agent that causes mad cow disease, that started in sheep, and it moved from sheep to cows. And the way that it moved from sheep to cows was by taking the bone meal of sheep and, you know, grinding it up and putting it into the feed that was used to feed cows, believe it or not. And so what you can imagine there is you're connecting so many thousands of different sheep, right? Because you'll take the bone meal from many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of sheep. It'll get into a single sheep, and it'll get into a single batch of cow feed, and that cow feed will go to, you know, potentially many thousands of cows. And what you've done there is made every possible connection between those thousands of sheep and thousands of cow And so even if the probability of that prion jumping would be very low, you have so many points of contact in the sort of industrial feed settings that it permitted that jump to occur, leading to mad cow, which of course later crossed into humans with the effect of the variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which was a devastating neurological illness.
What are we doing internationally in terms of public health awareness to assure that if something like H1N1 or any of these pandemics start to spread, that we have the ability or at least the mechanism in place to try and contain it?
The reality is that we have approached these sorts of problems with the sort of fire brigade bypass surgery approach for the last, 20 or 30 years. So I wouldn't say that we are maxed out in our capacity to sort of contain and respond. There's definitely capacity to improve that. But I think the real sort of cutting edge and the interesting areas of science will be in trying to find ways to, to detect these things very, very early and possibly to sort of predict the course of the movement of these pandemics and stop them. I mean, if you think about H1N1, for example, the so-called swine flu, H1N1 is dismissed by many people in the public as sort of an overreaction by public health officials, but there couldn't be anything further from the truth. I mean, this was an incredible example of sort of, if you want to think of it in this way, biological fireworks. This was a virus that went from infecting, some dozens of people to within a year infecting an approximate 10% of the human population. So, and it's a virus that killed tens of thousands, if not more than 100,000 individuals globally, and it continues to spread. So had this virus mutated or found another virus to swap genes with and become even nominally more deadly, it would have been, it would have killed millions of individuals. And so the reason that H1N1 was not, completely deadly for our global population is not because, we did anything to really stop its spread. It's basically that we just got lucky and nature handed us a virus that wasn't even that deadly.
Where in the world are you looking now for the next great pandemic to spring from?
Well, we have sites all throughout the world, and we're actually in the process of finding additional partners and additional donors to help us to expand even more broadly to be in more sites. So we work in 20 sites. They're distributed between Central Africa, Southeast Asia, East Asia, parts of South Asia, Central Asia, and South America. And we really need to double that number of sites in order to be able to do this well. We need to be monitoring animals in all of these different regions and getting repositories so we can understand the diversity of the things that are out there and what are the things that could potentially harm us in the future.
And as you talk about early on, there are just so many of these unseen life forms that are out there.
It's incredible. This is one of the absolutely amazing things about being a microbiologist today. And I sort of often discuss this with my Stanford students, and I have this thought experiment where it's like you put on these magical glasses and suddenly vertebrate flesh, all of the flesh of ourselves and the animals around us, sort of melts away, and you can just see the outlines of the microbes. And it's so profound how microbial our world is. And it's really as if we're sort of 19th century naturalists that suddenly have natural selection and the tools to understand all this diversity of life. We can go out and discover completely new forms of life all the time. And it gives a certain luxury of scientific exploration, which is largely absent from studies of things like vertebrates. Like, you could spend, 15, 20 years and never find a new species of primate, whereas our capacity to find these new viruses, you look down at your hand, there are completely unidentified viruses right there that are unknown to science.
And, of course, to bring it back kind of to where we started, what it reminds us is how fragile we are as a species.
I think so. Again, yes, there is a certain sort of fragile element to humanity, certainly if you think about it in the grander scheme over the course of thousands or tens of thousands of years. I mean, we represent a very limited slice of genetic diversity that in a certain moment of time, the one that we happen to be in, has spread remarkably throughout the planet. And if we take a step back, really, this is a planet which has been and is still dominated by microorganisms. On the other side of things, we have this incredible capacity to understand and to change elements of the world that we live in, and I think sort of uncovering this massive and previously sort of unseen world is going to provide us many, many opportunities to understand elements of our health and disease and to change them for the better.
And is it good for us to be scared? Is it good for us to be ever vigilant about this?
Absolutely, absolutely. I often envision this as, you know, we're very focused on the daily news cycle, and so most people can tell you when, when the stock market is up 2% or down 2%, but very few people could tell you how many cases of H5N1, the very deadly bird flu, continue to operate around the world. And yet, over the course of decades, the capacity for these viruses to create incredibly, incredibly dangerous scenarios on the planet, things like were portrayed in the movie Contagion, I think are very, very real threats, and yet ones that we have to help to focus people's attention on.
Dr. Nathan Wolf, his book is The Viral Storm, The Dawn of a New Pandemic Age. Nathan, I thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you.